accession number 28462, reel 8.
Went to. Anything else happened? Oh, we were there for 3 days and joined the trumpeter on September the 14th. And we did a bit of flying with her.
But was this your first deck landing? Because we actually haven't...
Oh, no, I beg your pardon. No, because before we finished our forming up, we went down to Norfolk, Virginia, and did our sort of passing out landings on USS Charger, which was an American small carrier. Can't find it now. Oh, here we are. No, it's not. Well, it was sometime. Sometime there we did our... Oh, here we are. August the 7th. Deck landings on USS Charger. It was a bit chaotic, actually, because... I think they started off with their deck landing officer, and they used their signals to the pilot, were the opposite to what we used. So all our pilots were trying to land on was getting the wrong instructions on, as to their height
and the wrong
when to cut. Yes,
pretty important stuff.
Yes, and so they managed to change over to our own deck landing officer, and then we carried out the landings okay.
Can you remember what the signals were?
Well, our signals, if you're too high, he held his bats up like that. The Americans did that, which meant go lower.
Right, I see. Okay.
So what our signals were telling the pilot what he was doing, the Americans were telling the pilot what he should do.
Yeah. Probably you could read something very important into that.
Well, it was.
So, but, I mean, you made... Because I've interviewed other pilots, and that first deck landing is always a pretty anxious moment. Can you remember?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't so anxious on that one, because the view from the Avenger was very good. It was more anxious for me when we did it in the Swordfish, which I think I missed out.
You did.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe we should talk... But hang on, just before we do that, I've got to do... no, I can just want to change a reel. So this will be Ian Templer Reel 8. And I've got to switch it off. Right. So, yes, we seem to have missed out the...
I'm afraid I did miss that island.
It doesn't matter. I mean, the Swordfish deck landings.
Yeah.
I think that's quite important.
Well, Swordfish deck landings were on HMS Argus in July 26, 1941.
You did talk about it briefly, didn't you? But we...
Well, we did talk about the aerodrome, the dummy deck landings.
That's right. Yeah. You were saying how easy it was for you in the...
Albacore.
In the Albacore.
Yeah.
But so, can you describe how it was in the Swordfish?
Well, in the Swordfish, as I think I did mention, I had to look through the two top cylinders to get the view of the deck. And doing it on the actual ship, the HMS Argus, which was the sort of training carrier, the first time was a bit scary. And you know, I thought, gosh, doesn't feel good at all. However...
Well, there were wires, and you had... How many wires?
That's right. You had there were about
wires?
Three or four arrestor wires, which the hook attached to the aircraft caught, hopefully, and that pulled the arrestor wire out against the hydraulic pressure and brought you to a very quick stop.
And you had a chance, if you missed it, to power up and get off again.
Well, if the deck landing officer decided that your approach wasn't good enough, he'd give you a signal to wave off and go around again. So, providing you weren't then so low that your hook caught a wire, you could go around again.
I see.
But
that signal you gave, I should describe that. It was like a sort of corkscrew above your head.
That's right, yes.
For
the
deck officer saying, get back up there and try again. But that didn't happen to you. You managed to... Because I suppose the first landing was pretty crucial because then your confidence built up.
Well, it was, actually. We had a sort of dummy flight first with... somebody who was experienced to give us a view of the deck so we could see what it looked like. And then after that we did six landings altogether. My first three landings took 25 minutes, my second three took 15 minutes. So that was... Then they passed us out, qualified deck landing training. the captain said, I don't think you knew what you were doing, but you didn't break anything, so you passed. They're always a bit sarcastic.
Because the captain of the ship had to be doing the right thing. He had to be steaming into the right direction at the right speed.
That's right, yeah.
What were you told to do if the ship was pitching and yawing?
Well, this was something that providentially I never had to face, but there are stories of ships, carriers on the Russian convoys, for instance, where they say swordfish would go out on an anti-submarine patrol, and they'd come back and find the deck was pitching up to 50 feet. And you had to time the landing so that you either got it as it was going down or got it when it was at the bottom of the pitch, because if you hit it when it was coming up, it could be make life rather difficult.
Mm. Understatement.
But but it did happen, of course, but amazingly, I think people managed to conquer the problem.
Great. So now we go on to your deck landings with the Tarpon. Do you call it the Tarpon or the Avenger?
Well, I call it the Avenger now, because it eventually became the Avenger.
All right, well, it's stay with Avenger.
Yeah.
You landed in Seattle and then you went out to the carrier.
That's right,
the Trumpeter.
Oh, yes, and we got out to there, yes.
And so landing, the first deck landing with the Avenger was not a problem?
No. Well, we'd done the deck landings on the American carrier, you see, so I had done it before. And we did some deck landing training straight away, in fact. We joined her on the 14th. On the 16th, I see I've got four deck landings. And the 20th, two deck landing with two 300-pound bombs. And 24th, five deck landings. So we were getting used to it. We thought, actually, we were going to be her squadron, you see, and we did a couple of AS patrols, anti-submarine patrols, on the way down. And then we came through the Panama Canal, because we were going down the west coast, through the Panama Canal, and up to, we called in at Norfolk. Did a bit of flying there. And then we thought, now we are going to be the squadron to escort a convoy across the Atlantic. Not a bit of it. We went to New York. Our aircraft were put down in one corner of the hangar, and we loaded up with I don't know how many Hellcat fighters, because they were all preparing for the Normandy invasion, so we were just used as a cargo ship, really, and came back from New York with a convoy. And
this is in, now, where are we?
That would have been late October.
1943.
And we got into...
What was it like crossing the Atlantic in a convoy? This is just...
Well, it was quite a fast convoy,
right,
actually.
And this was during pretty bad time for the Atlantic, wasn't it? Or was it just...
Well, no, we were getting on top then, right, I think, in October 43. There were still scares, but there was so much more anti-submarine work and success that...
Thanks to radar, largely, wasn't it? Thanks
well, radar, of course, and there was a lot
more.
There was a lot more air cover too, which makes a hell of a difference.
Sure. Mm. So it was quite a fast convoy. What, in 15 days or something like that?
Must have been about that, because October the 12th we were at Norfolk, so we still had to go up to New York. We were in New York for two or three days. It must have been about 8 or 9 days, I should think, because November the 3rd, we were landed at... before that. We were landed at Belfast about... Well, we were there for 4 or 5 days with the fog. The end of October, certainly, we were landed at Belfast with all the aircraft, and then we had to go on then up to... back to the Orkneys.
Back to the Orkneys?
Yeah.
Back to Swordfish?
No. Back to the Orkneys to be based there with the Avengers.
Oh, you were your aircraft were loaded onto the ships to come across.
The aircraft were in the ship. You see.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And we weren't flying them, because they were carrying
Hellcats.
A whole load of American fighters.
Oh, I understand.
For the army.
The trumpeter. In other words, yes, you came across in the carrier.
Yeah, we came across in the trumpeter.
Yep.
And then and we parted company with her at Belfast. And so we must have been 3 or 4 days in Belfast waiting for the weather to clear so that we could fly to Ayr and Arbroath and the Orkneys. Well, we were held up again by bad weather. We got to the Orkneys on the 6th of November, where, again, we sort of settled in and started doing more and more exercises again. And then it was at that point that I had a change of career altogether, because when I joined the squadron, all the pilots and observers, they were all given sort of specialist job to do within the squadron. Like, you'd have a safety officer who looked after the parachutes, you'd have a WT officer who was responsible for the radios, an armaments officer who was responsible for all the armaments, which was me. So when we got to back to the Orkneys and we did various bombing exercises, they were on a proper range and the results were produced, and I had to go and see the air gunnery officer of the air station to get the results. And he was quite friendly, we got on very well, and he said to me one day, "I'm going to put you in for the air gunnery officer's course." I said, "Oh no, you're not. I shall fight that. I want to go on flying." So he didn't say any more, and this went on. We went on doing this training, and then one day I was told to go with two observers to fly to Speke to pick up a tail wheel. I wondered why the hell they couldn't post it, I don't know. Anyway, we set off, and it was fairly cloudy. We followed the Caledonian Canal down to the west coast, with clouds each side of us on the mountains. Got out into the Solway Firth, and it became foggy. So I said to the chaps in the back, I said, "I don't like this very much. In fact, I'm going to try and hit the coast and find somewhere to land." And we found a place called Milham, RAF. It was an RAF navigation school. By this time, the visibility was pretty bad. So I did a circuit and went and landed. And taxied into the control tower. We all got out. And they said, You didn't probably realise there's a 2,000-foot hill just outside where you were circling. Anyway, we were talking in this control tower, and we had more engines overhead, and something went round two or three times, and then this twin-engine bomber, it wasn't a Wellington, it was a development of the Wellington, but it looked like a Wellington. This thing landed and taxied away, taxied round to the near where we were. Cockpit hood was back, and a long, blonde-headed girl got out. First time she'd flown one of those. She had the pilot's notes in one hand and the aeroplane in the other. She did two or three round again. Landed as cool as a cucumber.
Also dodging the 2,000-foot hill.
Yeah, I don't know whether she knew they were there.
And she was what, a delivery pilot, I suppose?
She was an ATA, yes, Air Transport Auxiliary, yeah. And so we stopped the night there. Subsequently discovered that our base had been recalling us all the morning, and these two senior observers in the back had been listening to the BBC. So we had quite a party that night, because the weather had been so bad, the RAF people had been grounded for a long time. They'd all spent all their mess bills. So they were very pleased to see us. They kept giving us cash and saying, "Well, you buy the drinks, but here's the money for you." Anyway, next morning, we went out to the aircraft in trepidation, because they had no battery trolleys there which would fit the Avenger. The Avenger had its own self-starting mechanism, but if your batteries were a bit low, you've got to make sure if you use the batteries it started first time. and it was a horrible, damp, foggy morning, sort of thing where you get condensation everywhere. So we did everything we possibly could in the book, and then decided to have a go, and thank God it started, because otherwise we'd have been there for I don't know how long. So this, continuing, this, we then had to go to Donibristle, which was the naval maintenance unit, because that aircraft was due for a major overhaul. So we went there, and I went into the wardroom to have some lunch, and I got a tap on the shoulder, and a voice said, "What are you doing here?" And this was the Instructor Lieutenant Commander Burnett, who had been the Chief Meteorological Officer at Hatstone when I was filling in the weather charts. So I told him, you know, what I'd been doing, because it was he, of course, that put me, put my request for a pilot's course into the captain. And I told him what I'd been doing. He said, "Well, you know, you ought to go and do this air gunnery officer's course." He said, "You can't go on, you've been flying for 3 years, you can't go on forever, and we want people like you who've got some experience and you've got the right seniority now." And I thought, well, there's two people who've been saying this to me, I think I'll do it. And there were a whole lot of our squadron people who had been being moved around, so I went back and said, "Well, I'm going to apply for this," and I was whipped down to Portsmouth very quickly. That was, that Donibristle visit was December the 19th.
Of 1943,
and I think that air gunnery course that I went on started in January 44. I was home for Christmas and then went down to Portsmouth, and that was to Whale Island.
And was there a time, I mean, did pilots recognise after 3 or 4 years that was time enough? It was time.
No, not really. I mean, I had no thoughts of doing anything else. I'd heard of this gunnery business, but people didn't seem to think much of it. But two people having said that to me, I thought, well, yes, maybe you're right. And in fact, again, I was lucky because the squadron eventually went out to the Pacific Fleet, and they were in it was Indomitable, I think, the aircraft carrier, which got kamikaze bombed twice. And I don't think they had any casualties on raids, because they went and bombed Japan itself. So that would have been a bit hairy. So I was packed off to Portsmouth to do this course, which I did enjoy, actually. It was a good course. And once again, a lot of parade ground stuff.
Really?
Yeah, that was what, about the fourth time I'd done it in my life. But it was like going back to school, because we had some very fierce lectures. We had all sorts of things to learn, like to do with ballistics and gun sights and bombs, and not only that, but naval gunnery as well. We had to be able to cope with. And at the end of that, with one little funny incident on that course, we were able to do a bit of flying, and I went over to Leon Solent once and flew a swordfish, and it was only about within the last year, I was looking at this and thinking, I'd flown that before. And I had flown it up in the Orkneys when we were first there.
It was the same plane.
Same plane, yeah. Funny coincidence. It had lasted all that time. Mm. Oh, here we are. V4378. Look, whole column of it.
Yes, extraordinary. And there you go.
V4378.
Somewhat nearly 4 years, three years later.
Yeah, almost exactly. And then during that course, we went down to St. Merin, one of the ideas being that we could fly a Hurricane. but primarily, we had to go to Yeovilton first to have some dual instruction on monoplanes. And it turned out of the, I think it was eight of us on the course, I was the only one that had flown a monoplane. So they had no aeroplane at Yeovilton to give us dual control on. So we went on to St. Merin, where the action was to be. And the course officer got permission for me to fly a Hurricane, which I did 4 times, which was magnificent. Except on the first flight, I couldn't get the undercarriage down. and I was struggling to get it down. The lever was on this side.
On your right side.
Yeah. And all the time I was leaning forward, I was pulling the control column back, and I suddenly felt the left wing tip. And I was only about 500 feet. God, I thought, this is it. And I slammed the throttle open, and it picked up and carried me away safely. And I thought, well, I'll go away a bit in case anybody saw that.
And you got the undercarriage down.
And then I came back, flipped it, they went down, no trouble at all. But I was told afterwards by a friend that with opening the throttle like that, I was jolly lucky, because normally, if you do that apparently with a Merlin engine, it just dies on you. So that was a lucky one.
Have you heard also the way of getting this, if the undercarriage didn't come down, you had to, in sea fires anyway, you had to fly upside down to get it to go back into its housing properly, then turn
yes.
back around and come back down. I don't know if that was an accepted technique that you were warned of.
I wasn't warned of that. No. I wasn't warned of anything.
Oh, I see. So the hurricane...
I was just told, the hurricane's over there. I walked out to it, and there was a pair of legs dangling from the cockpit, which turned out to be a wren. And I said, do you know how to start these? She said, no, I'm only a rigger, I'm not a fitter. So I had to find out for myself how to start it. But it really was, I mean, I know now why people say, you know, the Hurricanes and the Spitfires are so lovely to fly. It really was, once you'd flown it, you felt you were part of it. And it sat down on the ground and landed and just rolled along beautifully. You know, I was all sorry that I couldn't fly it a bit more.
And this is Merin in
Cornwall.
In Cornwall.
Mm.
That's a strange place to fly.
And then I met, after that bit, we were given, it was the end of the course. We had a weekend's leave before going back to, I think before we went back to, when do I start something? You know, we had to go back to Whale Island again to finish off the course. And I, at St Merin that day, I ran into a chap called Horsley. Have you ever come across him? Lieutenant Commander Horsley. He wrote a book called Find, Fix and Strike about the Fleet Air Arm. And I'd given him this sort of interview when I'd got back from the Middle East. And he was there anyway. And said, Mary, oh, hello. You know, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm about to go and catch a train, go all the way to London to go home for a weekend. Oh, he said, don't worry about that. I'll take you to Heathrow. I've got my own aeroplane. He was a sort of official author of Fleet Air Arm stories appointed by the Admiralty, and they'd given him a Proctor, his own aeroplane. So we set off from St Merin about 2:30, I should think, and I was home in Sevenoaks at 6:30. We went to Heathrow, which was then the Ferry Aviation's works, and no airport or anything like that. Had a cup of tea. They took me in a car to Austerley Station, got the tube up to Charing Cross, train down to Sevenoaks, got home. My father said, have you seen a flying bomb yet? I said, no. He said, well, I'll show you one in 5 minutes. I said, well, I must just go up to the loo first. I went up to the bathroom, relieving myself, and I heard this awful droning noise. I looked out of the window, and there was this flying bomb, you know, about 1/2 mile away, flying up there. And up the road from where they lived, there was a balloon cable. And I could see the cable. I've never stopped doing what I was doing so quickly. And I got down the stairs and under the table. I was under the table by the time it hit the ground, because once the engine stops, it comes down.
And you heard that moment when it stopped?
I heard it stop, yeah.
And where did it come down?
Went down in the field.
Close by? Enough to rattle
Well, it rattled things a bit, but and then I was home actually for quite a long time before I got my appointment, and it was during the flying bomb peak actually. They were coming over all the time. It was a hot August, and you slept with the windows open, and these things came over, and I thought, my God, it's coming through the window. But we didn't suffer any damage from those.
And you wouldn't go down to the shelters, would you? Because they.
Well,
we hadn't got
a shelter. All we'd got actually was whose was it? It wasn't the Anderson shelter. It was the thing like a table made of fairly heavy gauge steel, which you could get under. It would protect you from falling debris. It wouldn't protect you from blast if it got too close, but it was some protection anyway.
So now you've qualified as a...
So I've now qualified as an air gunnery officer.
We've rather sort of glossed through that. I mean, there must have been a huge amount of material that was... How long was that course?
Oh, it was 7 months.
7 months? Mm, good heavens. So this was from...
From January...
44.
44, yes. So... To the end of July.
That's a very detailed...
It was. It was very, very compressed, very...
I mean, can you talk us... I haven't got much time, but I mean, what was the broad gist of it? What areas were there?
Well, the main things were familiarity with the weapons. The Browning machine gun, for instance, we had to learn to strip it and put it together again and then do it blindfold. So you had to really know what it was. There were other sessions of mathematics where... You were looking at the way bullets or bombs behaved in the air and how much allowance had got to be made for either wind or the peculiarities of the weapon itself and all that sort of thing. And a lot of trigonometry and stuff like that came into it. I was finding, you know, I've still got my book of all the exercises we did in the evenings. It would always do probably an hour and a half homework, working out the answers to problems, a lot of which were governed by formulae, which we were given. You say, this is the formula you use for this. We haven't got time to prove it, but that's it. So if you want to find out what happens when you do this or you don't do that, you use that formula. Don't question where it came from, but it's there, because there isn't time to sort of take you through all the proof of it like you did at school if you were learning Pythagoras or Euclid or whatever. There was that, and there was also naval gunnery, you know, how you had to learn gun drill and all that kind of thing. Parade ground stuff, which I've covered. We had to... In fact, we did virtually what we used to do in the OTC. You had to sort of teach your class detailed movements, like how you present arms or that sort of thing, which in the end was useful because I had to do that eventually with the crew that we had.
What about what rockets? Else? Did you cover rockets or
not at that time? No, no. I did come across rockets later, but never actually used them. They were on a fairly restricted basis. We had some in the ship I was in after this, but we never actually used them. I think we carried them for other people. So I think that was...
Okay.
With all this parade ground stuff, you had to march your own class past on divisions in the morning, learn how to salute with a sword. Of course, I got it wrong. I got it on the wrong foot. And before I got to the end of the parade ground, there was a messenger holding a note up in front of me from the commander who gave the command on the wrong foot. There was a lot of discipline, but it was interesting, actually, because one of the... I think it was a leading seaman or a petty officer came up to me one day and said, "Hello, so fancy seeing you here." And it was one of the people who had been on one of the squadrons I'd been in. And I said, "Well, how are you? What are you doing here?" He said, "Well, I'm just doing, I think it was a month's course or something like that." He said, "But it's really good. It's wonderful to see everybody being treated exactly the same." I said, "It is, isn't it?" Yes.
So yeah, well, you had the squad, you know, officers, yeah. and rankers and everybody.
Well, no, we were all in our squad. We were all officers because we were all on the same course,
but, yep.
And we didn't actually take charge of any other ranks that time.
Oh, I see what you mean. Mm. So now you're posted to your first...
So then I was...
As a gunnery...
Air gunnery officer to HMS Hunter, which was an assault escort carrier with sea fires. And when I was appointed to her, she was in the Aegean. And she was also involved in the French landings in the south of France. But I couldn't get... I wasn't given instructions to join her straight away, and I was home for about 2 months. And then got the go, went out in a troop ship to Malta From Malta, I was flown to Cairo. Cairo, I got the train up to Alexandria. And then I got a boat. Hunter was then in Alexandria. And the boat came, picked me up to take up my appointment. She promptly sailed for home. And we went back to Portsmouth. The squadron flew ashore.